This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. I want to start by apologizing. Last week, we ran into some technical difficulties and had to interrupt the show before we got to our guest, who has been gracious enough to rejoin us in the second half of the program, that being Dr. Kapil Milavidu. Dr. Milavidu is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut. He's also director of the Blood and Bone Marrow Transplantation Service. And 2 weeks ago, we had a chat with Dr. Milavidu about a variety of blood-borne cancers and different leukemias, myelomas. And we were just getting into treatment and discuss some of the treatments, but what we really wanted to go over was his area of expertise being marrow transplant. You know, we hear a lot about bone marrow transplants, stem cell transplants, and really this is kind of the brave new world of treating these blood cancers. So he's agreed to come back and will be with us in the second half of the program, and I'm happy to take questions from any of you regarding this. For Dr. Milavidu, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com, and we will ask him those questions live on the air. This month will mark the completion of our 15th year on the air here at Healthy Rounds. And for any regular listeners of the program, you know, every year at our anniversary, which is typically in November, I will thank many people who were responsible for putting this show together. One of those people, probably the most important person in putting this show together, was a fellow by the name of Gene Sheehan. Gene Sheehan unfortunately passed away this July, and I just became aware of that since I was out of the country when I ran into Steve Salhaney. Gene Sheehan was kind of the public relations guru of Hartford and all around Connecticut. He was dubbed the PR king from the standpoint that he had a way of connecting people together and connecting with people. I first encountered Gene when I was asked to do some advocacy work for his firm on behalf of people with epilepsy, and there was a move toward insurance companies being able to provide medications that were not the brand name. So these various generic anticonvulsant treatments, and they weren't the same. You know how everybody says, well, the generic is the same. When it came to certain anticonvulsant medications, they were not the same. So I came under Gene's tutelage to some degree because he taught me a great deal about how to do an interview. And we got to talking, and I told him I had a radio show on then what was then WXLM in New London. And he connected me with Steve Salhaney and with Ray Dunaway and really advocated for this program to come on the air. And it was a perfect time because they were looking for a health-related program. So Gene was that kind of person. And he was always available for a favor. If you needed something, Gene would know the right person to go to. One story I'd had to share is it came to my attention of a young man who was in the Army. The Army Reserve wanted to go to the active duty Navy. And for him to get into this position with the Navy, a lot of paperwork had to be done. Well, the paperwork was being taken months and months, and no one wanted to complete this paperwork in the Army to get this done. and the position that he was applying for was going to expire. His brother came to me and said, "Do you think you could do something?" And I called Gene. And sure enough, the next day, the young man got a call from somewhere in Arizona saying that they got a call from Washington, D.C. They said, "I don't know who you knew, but I've been told to get this paperwork done by the end of the day." And that man went on to have a very successful career in the United States Navy. So, again, that's the kind of person Gene Sheehan was. And I just always remember him, and we should all remember him, as really being the person who advocated the greatest for this program. And I extend my condolences to his wife and family. This day in medicine, October 12, 1879, Dr. René Lariche was born. Dr. Lariche was a French surgeon, and he's often dubbed the father of vascular surgery. And he described, naturally, what's named after him, Lariche's syndrome, which is basically thrombotic occlusion of the distal abdominal aorta. Basically, the main artery going to your legs becomes clogged. And as a result, you develop symptoms where your legs are very cold. There is what we call vasogenic claudication, which is when you're walking, and a lot of people experience this, when you're walking, suddenly your legs start to cramp up, they become cold and weak, so you have to sit down. And after you sit down for about 5 minutes, you're able to get up again and start walking again until this occurs again. So, you know, basically he identified the problem but didn't have a solution for it, as we know now. I mean, now when you think about a condition that clogs these main arteries, there are so many approaches to it, right? You can take medication that will make the arteries larger, dilate them to get more circulation to your legs. There are non-invasive procedures that can be done to clean out the artery, and we can go all the way to replacing the abdominal aorta. So it's interesting that he was able to identify this problem in 1879, a problem we still encounter today. The only difference being is we have a solution for that. This season has been sports season. It's been very busy for myself and my daughter, Stephanie, in seeing athletes who have head injuries. And lately, I've seen several young women who play goalie in soccer and are getting hit in the head. Now, it's not so much getting hit with the soccer ball, but when they go to cover up, another athlete will inadvertently kick them in the head. They make helmets that are legitimate for soccer goalies to wear. They're basically heavily cushioned pads. They're not hard helmets like football. They're designed to be very comfortable. And I have recommended these for many years, especially, and made them mandatory if an athlete with a concussion wants to go back to playing goalie. And we're starting to see them more and more. You know, there are the issues of vanity. They look odd. They look different. But if you're playing goalie and you stand the risk of being kicked in the head, it really pays off. So something for parents and grandparents to consider when talking to their children and grandchildren about using some level of protection in this particular position. With that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back, and we're going to talk a few big topics. You know, what I just mentioned, it's always good when you identify a problem, but do you have a solution? So we're going to talk about gradually finding a solution to make our healthcare system better. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you again on this Saturday morning. One of the things I like is the fact that when you identify a problem, can you come up with a possible solution? I'm going to throw this out to everybody, but what I'd like to do is talk about our healthcare system in America right now. We can all agree, all parties agree that this system is broken. And by what I mean by all parties is patients are not happy, providers, particularly physicians, are not happy with the system, and the government sure isn't happy with it because they're paying too much. We pay various degrees more than any other country toward our health care. And what is the problem with that? Because we are declining in our ability to stay healthy. We are not the healthiest country in the world. So with that, we should take a look at the system and see what we could do to make it better. And there are various aspects to it. Well, first of all, there's medication. Why are we paying so much for medication? There's access to the system. Why can't I find a doctor or a provider when I need them? Paying. Who's going to pay for this system? And then we have to look at the various obstacles that we face. So with that, I decided we would start with medication. Now, we all know that there are certain basic medications, and then there are the higher level medications to treat illnesses. Probably the best system, and people may criticize me for this, but the Veterans Administration system has worked very well for many years. It has fallen into some level of disrepair, but for a lot of people, it has been a life preserver for health care, especially when it comes to medication. Now, why is that? Well, there's a thing called the federal schedule, and this is a list of medications that are provided at minimal cost to the government for the care of veterans, active military, Native Americans, and Native Alaskans. So those groups get access to the federal schedule. So, as many veterans who are listening will know that you can get medication for free. Is it going to be the latest and the greatest? Probably not. But is it sufficient to treat your medication, your illness? And the answer is yes. They have to be proven medication. They're not something made in somebody's basement. But again, the manufacturers have to provide this at a low cost to the government. So really, what we're talking about is trying to create a system that is not socialized. So I don't like the term socialized medicine, because what we're talking about is a universal system. In a socialized system, right, everybody gets the same care. Now, I'm advocating for a system where people will all have some access to care, but if you want better care, you can pay for it. You can buy insurance and get a better level of care. But at least everybody can go somewhere at no cost to them to get treated, because it's happening now. The only problem is it's happening too late. What we're doing is we're taking care of people after they become sick. So there's nowhere to go for preventive treatment. And when they show up in the hospital, we're paying for it. All of us, all the taxpayers are paying for it. So with medication, I advocate for giving everyone on Medicare or anyone on a universal health care system access to this federal schedule. Now you might say, well, that's going to affect the various drug companies, pharma. Not really, because there are enough people out there who have commercial insurance or are willing to invest in insurance or invest in getting the latest and the greatest, these different ads you see on TV all the time. Those are not drugs that you're going to see on the federal schedule. But you'll be able to get your insulin for free. It may not be the latest and the greatest, whatever they're advertising, but you're going to get insulin to control your diabetes. And it's not going to cost you anything. That's what we need to be shooting for, is a universal system. So Today, I wanted to bring up the idea of medications, and it extends from medications. We've talked on this program about hearing aids and how they affect you. Again, hearing aids, something the VA provides, maybe it should be opened up to others. Are they the latest and the greatest hearing aids? Probably not. But they're enough so that people can hear and make them safe. So if you have questions about what I'm talking about, if you have other ideas on the topic of medications, that would be great. What I hope to is address the other issues, right? Access is a big issue. Where are we getting doctors to do this? To work for a lower wage, possibly, and see patients for free? We're going to discuss all of that. One thing I came across this week that I wanted to talk a little bit about is the loss of the sense of smell. Loss of smell is now often described as, it can be, and I don't want to make this sound like everybody who's lost their sense of smell. People who have lost their sense of smell may be a precursor to Parkinson's disease or dementia. Now, we could also see it from COVID, but people who have lost their sense of smell are three times more likely to experience a smell-related hazard than someone who has not. And when we think about that, smell-related hazards are things like cooking or gas fires, a gas leak, even eating spoiled food is a problem if you've lost your sense of smell. Now, there are ways of getting it back because you can, in some respects, retrain the brain for these senses of for the sense of smell. And there are specialists who address this. There are therapists who address this. And it's really a system of recognizing the smell, either a picture of what it is, along with a smell that might be somewhat more pungent, in order to try to retrain those brain pathways to identify different smells. So again, there are ways of approaching this with therapy, but it's something we don't think about an awful lot in terms of losing your sense of smell. And also, if you have lost your sense of smell, please bring it up with your doctor because it could be the sign of some other illness that needs to be addressed and treated. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Kapil Milavidu. And we're going to be talking a lot about bone marrow transplantation. I already have a question here in about stem cell transplantations as a means of treatment. So we want to talk about that and how we approach these various blood cancers that we hear more and more about. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest once again and bring him back, Dr. Kapil Milavidu. Dr. Milavidu is on the faculty at the University of Connecticut, where he's an assistant professor of medicine. He's also director of the Blood and Marrow Transplantation Service at the University of Connecticut. Kapil, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me back again.
All right. And I apologize again for last week's snafu, but I'm glad you're able to get back with us. When we last spoke, we talked a lot about the bone marrow. So maybe as a quick review, can we talk a little bit about the purpose of the bone marrow and its importance in our hematologic system and its importance when things go wrong?
Yeah, so a bone marrow is a very essential part of the hematopoietic or the blood system. The simple way that I think about bone marrow is the factory where all the blood cells are made. And when I say blood cells, that includes, you know, the red blood cells which carry oxygen to your brain, to your muscles, to your vital organs. and then platelets, which are, you know, the band-aid that you have in your, you know, natural band-aid that you have, which prevents bleeding from happening, and it comes and helps form a clot. And the third important cell are the white blood cells, which can be, you know, grouped into many other subtypes of white blood cells, but basically white blood cells are the defense mechanism of the body. It gives us the immune system. And interestingly, it also keeps us who we are. It maintains ourselves, as we call it, and protects us from all the foreign invasions, be it bacteria, virus, or fungi. So all of these, you know, cells are made from the bone marrow. So bone marrow is a very, very important part of the of our body. Yeah.
Let's talk then a little bit about transplantation. You know, we hear a lot about bone marrow transplant, bone marrow donors, and, you know, the fact that someone who does get a bone marrow transplant, they have to live in isolation for a period of months. Can we talk about the process? Because the last time you actually informed me of something I hadn't known, and that was that, you know, to be a bone marrow donor, you can't be older than the age of 40. So can we talk a little bit about donation and the whole process of marrow transplantation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I can, you know, elaborate more on that discussion from before, Tony. So, but I think just for, you know, us to kind of get the basics, the process of bone marrow transplantation simply means that we're placing a faulty bone marrow by infusion of healthy stem cells. It is not a surgery. Sometimes when you hear the word transplant, many people might have some experience or might have heard of, you know, kidney transplant or heart transplant, which is all done by a surgeon, whereas a bone marrow transplant, or, you know, sometimes these days also called as blood and marrow transplant. Sometimes you might hear stem cell transplant. These is all one and the same. It is a medical procedure where it simply is an infusion of blood stem cells.
So why is it, but let's talk a bit about the part about where we're so worried about them becoming infected. So how long is it when someone has a transplant that they have to be isolated?
Yeah, so so to understand that, I think, you know, I'm going to explain a little bit in detail about different types of transplant, because there's, you know, two broad categories of stem cell transplant or bone marrow transplant. One type of bone marrow transplants involve taking a person's own body stem cells, extracting it, and infusing back into the same person. So this is called as a autologous stem cell transplant or autologous bone marrow transplant. This is relatively considered less intense or less complex as compared to the other type of bone marrow transplant, which I'll talk about in a minute. So autologous transplant is done for some specific types of cancers, which also we can come back to. But it is in a way, autologous stem cell transplant, even though the word says autologous, is really, you know, built on the basis of, you know, a high dose chemotherapy, which is given to the patient. And then, the stem cells that have been extracted before ahead of time, you try to do that a couple of weeks ahead of time, they're infused back into the same person. So the side effects or the immune problems and the length of stay, all of that, you know, is determined by that intensity of the chemotherapy, actually. So, you know, most people are kept in the hospital for 2, at the most 3 weeks, depending on, you know, some of the side effects. And by the end of 3 weeks, you expect your own stem cells that was infused back to you to grow back, so you are able to be, you know, discharged. Now, these days, again, the things have gotten so better in terms of supportive care and infection prevention and an access to healthcare, that sometimes even autologous transplants can be done as an outpatient procedure, meaning, you know, they come in every day to the cancer center and they go home. So, you know, some of the centers in, you know, Boston, New York, you know, Stanford, a lot of these big centers which do this autologous transplant have routinely changed their autologous transplant program to an outpatient procedure. So there, the intensity and the complexity, even though it's there, it is, you know, managed as even as an outpatient procedure, which is a huge, you know, it's a huge difference. There's a very different kind of transplant, which is the classic bone marrow transplant, which is where we talked about, you know, a donor availability and the donor age and everything last time. And that's called an allogeneic bone marrow transplant or allogeneic stem cell transplant. This involves actually requiring a donor because you're using not the self or the person's own body stem cells. In allogeneic stem cell transplant, you have to use a healthy donor, which could be a family member, if you have a sibling or even a parent, if they are healthy, or an unrelated donor, which could be anywhere in the world. So you have to, you know, retrieve the stem cells from this donor, and then the patient themselves, again, receives some form of chemotherapy, and they're in the hospital. And these other alternative donor, you know, choice stem cells are infused into the body. This is a little bit more complex because you have to be on immune suppression because you're receiving another person's stem cells. And you have to be in the hospital minimum 4 weeks. This is rarely done as outpatient. It's almost done in the hospital, and they are in the hospital. And their recovery is also kind of longer because they, you know, their immune system is considered very naive, and they are susceptible for more infections for many months after transplant. But they generally discharge again by the end of a month, but they have to, you know, follow some precautions, and they'll be very closely followed. So these are two different broader types of transplant and, you know, different length of hospital stay, different degree of complications.
So, Kapil, I've got some basic questions, I guess. One is logistics. So if you're getting a marrow transplant, when you say stem cell transplant, we're using it synonymously with a marrow transplant. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. These days, I think they are one and the same. There's a subtle difference, which I can kind of, you know, in the original days when this whole field was evolving, the infusion itself was extracted by doing a bone marrow. So it was a bone marrow stem cell that you extract and then infuse into the veins. So that's why the original term, you know, bone marrow transplant came upon. But these days, I would say more than 80-90% of these stem cells are extracted from the peripheral vein. Nobody needs to undergo a bone marrow biopsy procedure because you have injections that you can give to bring the stem cells out from the bone marrow into the bloodstream, and you can collect it from the bloodstream and you can infuse it, you know, back into the patient. So that's why you call it more like a stem cell transplant, but their idea is one and the same. And we don't, you know, typically have to require a bone marrow sample in the vast majority these days.
From a logistical standpoint, so the person who's donating their stem cells, right, for a marrow transplant, do they have to undergo a marrow extraction to do that?
Yeah, so like you said, I think, you know, these days, almost like, you know, 80-90% of the bone marrows are collected from a peripheral vein. So they do not need to undergo a bone marrow aspiration or bone marrow procedure or anything like that. So logistically, what happens is if somebody decides to become a donor, and if you're registered in the, you know, or registry, and you happen to become the perfect match for somebody, you know, with a problem with like leukemia or bone marrow failure that, you know, that needs a bone marrow transplant, the donor will need to see a local bone marrow transplant team, which the NMDP or the National Marrow Donor Program will coordinate. They'll call, they'll coordinate, they'll guide the donor to go to a local place where they get tested. The donor get tested with some blood tests and make sure that they are healthy and that they don't have infections and, you know, they don't have any major health issues to become a donor. So that's called as a donor screening. So they have to undergo that. And then once they are cleared, they are given an injection of a growth factor 5 days in a row. And this is a quick injection. They don't have to stay in the hospital. It's done in the cancer center or outpatient, you know, clinic where they have to go 5 days in a row, get their injections. Then on the fifth day, they have to spend a little longer time in the infusion room or in the outpatient pavilion again, where they're connected to kind of a machine similar to a dialysis machine, very similar. We call it a apheresis machine, mm-hmm. Where what happens is the blood is extracted and returned via another IV cannula, but the machine extracts just the stem cells, nothing else. The injections help mobilize this, you know, stem cells into the bloodstream, like I told before. So that is almost a 4 to 5 hour procedure, sometimes 4 to 6 hours. So it's really like, you know, morning 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock to like evening 3 o'clock kind of procedure where, you know, the donor have to be in an infusion outpatient center and then they are sent home after that. So that's pretty much is, you know, what a bone marrow or a stem cell transplant donation looks like logistically. Now, there is one particular condition where the donor may be requested to donate the actual bone marrow. And that's when the patient has to get a bone marrow transplant for a condition called as a bone marrow failure syndrome. So not for leukemia, not for other things, but if your bone marrow is completely failing and you have to replace a bone marrow, studies have shown that an actual bone marrow infusion may be a lot more safer than this stem cell infusion or the peripheral blood stem cell infusion. So that's kind of like I said, the 10%, where the donor are still given a choice. They are asked, like, you know, are you okay donating an actual bone marrow instead of this, you know, peripheral blood donation? They still have a choice to say yes or no. So that's kind of a minority where, you know, we still use the bone marrow as a source, but in the vast majority, it's just peripheral blood.
Is that for like myelodysplasia where you would use that?
No, myelodysplasia or leukemia, you have to have, the donor stem cells collected either way. You can, you know, donate gotcha. Like peripheral blood or marrow. But the condition that I was alluding to, more common one that we know of is aplastic anemia.
Okay.
You know, severe aplastic sure. anemia or bone marrow failure is seen in more younger like kids, like, you know, congenitally, they are born with some syndromes where your bone marrow is not functioning at all. So essentially, they need a replacement of the bone marrow. They don't need anything else. They just need a healthy bone marrow. So in those situations are where an actual bone marrow, you know, stem cell infusion is sought.
When you said it could be done anywhere in the world, so say someone is a donor here, but they're a match, I don't know, in another country or in another state, can it be safely, is there a shelf life, is there, you know, a time frame where we have to get the marrow there or the stem cells
yeah.
there?
Yeah. So this is a very well coordinated, system. Internationally, there's a whole team of volunteers, whole, you know, organizations which are completely dedicated to ensure that a stem cells get transported across the country lines and across the borders. There are, you know, huge laws and regulations around it. It's a very tightly coordinated and controlled and regulated process. In the U.S., like I said, the main body which helps make all of this happen is Be the Match or National Marrow Donor Program. So what they do is they have this collaborative network across the world where they would call a local hospital which participates in a transplant program. So if a donor, let's say, like you said, is here in U.S. and the patient is in Australia, or the other way. Let's say, you know, the patient is here in U.S. and your match was found in Australia. They don't have to come all the way here. They actually go to a local center in Australia, and they donate the stem cells there. And these stem cells are FedExed or couriered in a very, again, special way, highly regulated and in-person handoff way. There's a chain of custody that needs to be maintained, and that's safely delivered to the U.S. So generally, the shelf life, if you were to ask, is, you know, there is usually, you know, a day, two or three, even sometimes, where the fresh stem cells remain healthy and can be infused back. There's also a special way you have to transport it, maintaining some of the temperature and things, regulations, if it's more than that, you know, time window. But, you know, this field has existed now for, you know, 30, 40 years. And I can tell you that if you talk to NMDP folks, they would say they're so proud of the work that they're doing that even during COVID, even during the peak of pandemic, where everything was shut down, including, you know, airports and transits and everything, stem cell transplant was the only one which continued to happen. So it is an enormously, you know, important life-saving procedure that is highly regulated and very well coordinated.
Well, you know, that's amazing. But you've already touched on at least one of the conditions with aplastic anemia. But what are some of the conditions where we're now using stem cell transplantation? And at what point do you use stem cell transplantation?
Yeah, great question. So broadly, again, you know, as a class, you know, the couple of areas that somebody would recommend a bone marrow transplant is any disorders of immune function, especially like inherited or familial disorders. This happens usually in the pediatric age group. The other class of disorders where you would consider a bone marrow transplant is a bone marrow failure state, like some of the examples that I mentioned, and I'll come back to this. And the third most common indication or reason is leukemias, where you would consider this. So for all these three indications, you know, allogenic stem cell transplant is what is indicated, like you would need another donor to undergo stem cell transplant. So most common, I would say, in U.S. For, you know, someone to undergo an allo transplant would be acute myeloid leukemia, myelodysplastic syndrome, and rarely, you know, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, even in the adult population. Sometimes even some of the aggressive lymphomas, like, you know, non-Hodgkin's and Hodgkin's, and rarely CML and CLL. So these are all the disorders where, you know, allogenic stem cell transplant has a curative potential. Versus, remember the first kind of transplant that I talked about, which is a little bit less complicated, the autologous stem cell transplant, yeah, where you use one's own stem cells. They are indicated mostly for multiple myeloma. That's one of the most common indications where somebody would undergo an autologous stem cell transplant, closely followed by lymphomas, both Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's, as well as recently there's a very increasing data and some scientific rationale for doing autologous transplant in even non-malignant, non-cancerous condition like multiple sclerosis and autoimmune conditions. So that's the length and breadth of really indications of doing an auto or an allo. And I think you had a second part to the question, right? Like, what point of these disorders do you do these?
Sure.
I think, yeah, each of these, you know, disorders are slightly different on the timeline of when you do it. I think it's a little bit more elaborate. But briefly, I think, you know, acute myeloid leukemia and MDS and ALL and ones that I kind of talked about, you do consider this as the curative treatment options up front, meaning, you know, as soon as you're diagnosed and somebody is fit and healthy to undergo something like this, they have to undergo a couple of rounds of chemotherapy to make sure the leukemia, it remains controlled. And then you would offer in allogeneic stem cell transplant as a form of potential cure. In multiple myeloma also, you know, these days, again, you know, there are definitely a lot more other choices coming up, but it remains a standard of care that anybody who gets diagnosed with multiple myeloma, autologous stem cell transplant is indicated in the first remission. Whereas in lymphomas, Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's are the other reasons, you don't do it as the first line, meaning, you know, most people would respond to your standard chemotherapy and they go into long remission, sometimes even cure potential, so you don't do that up front. But if at all, if the Hodgkin's lymphoma or the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma were to come back or relapse, that's the time that you do an autologous transplant for in lymphomas.
Kapil, I've only got a couple of minutes left, but I have a question here from Lou asking, and it's already something you touched on. Can you ask your speaker regarding the topic of MS stem cell transplant treatment? Can you just bring us up to speed in a couple of minutes about the treatment of MS and autoimmune disorders with stem cell transplants?
Right. So this is currently being explored and as part of clinical trials across the U.S. There is a clinical trial network called as BEAT, like BEAT MS, where autologous stem cell transplant are offered for multiple sclerosis patients. Now, outside U.S., especially in, you know, other countries like Mexico, South America, there's a lot more people who are undergoing a successful autologous transplant. But I think it's not standard of care in a clinical scenario yet within U.S., but there's huge amount of efforts going on. I actually recently even was working with our neurology colleagues here at UConn Health to change some policies around making it more accessible for multiple sclerosis patients. So autologous transplant is what is usually considered as an option for multiple sclerosis. It is not for every kind of multiple sclerosis patients that you offer it for. It's usually the early presentations, and after, you know, consulting with a neurologist, working very closely with them, you do try to get some of these young patients before any major disability sets in to offer this treatment choice. And the way that it works is you still have to get some high-dose chemotherapy. They are in the hospital, but they are infused their own stem cells back, so you do not need another donor for that. So, that's really
very exciting.
Even coming up, yeah.
Well, that was very exciting. Once again, we're out of time. Kapil, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for everything you do. Many thanks to Kevin Korza, who's been on the board today, and Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing, as always, for Healthy Rounds. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.